Okay, let's start our last talk. Professor Chivukula will give the closing talk on perspective on high-end physics.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful conference, and I hope you've all learned as much as I have. My brief was to try to give some kind of a perspective, and so this is my illustration of what the issue is. We've learned a lot about the Standard Model, about supersymmetry, about Technicolor, about Higgs-less models, and there are even other possibilities, some of which are illustrated there. And if you're an experimentalist, especially, you might wonder how all of these things are related to one another, how they fit together, and what different directions they might point. And if you're a theorist, a student who's a theorist, you might wonder, well, which of these should I work on and what should I be doing? And so what I'm going to try to do in this talk is to give you some sense of a possible answer to those questions. But since this is a perspective, there will be some amount of opinion. And if I'm successful, that opinion will be controversial enough that we'll actually be able to start a discussion. So I think it's worth starting with an idea of where we are in the history of particle physics. Almost no one ever learns particle physics historically anymore, and it's a good thing because it's a terribly confusing way to learn. But it is important to know something about the different ages of our knowledge of particle physics. And roughly speaking, I would say that particle physics in modern particle physics divides into three ages. The first age is before about 1974, where, if you want, experimentalists were ahead of the theorists. There were lots and lots of particles, lots of possible interactions, and few unifying principles, although there were some that were starting to be understood, such as the quark model and SU3. Then around 1974, and that boundary is somewhat arbitrary, but around 1974, a number of things happened. There was the discovery of charm. There was the establishment of the renormalizability of the electroweak interactions, SU2 cross U1. There was the discovery of weak neutral currents at Gargamel, which is a little earlier as well. So around that time, starting around 1974, we've been in what one might call the Standard Model Age. And I think, roughly speaking, it's fair to say, in this age, unfortunately, the theorists have been ahead of the experimentalists. Many, if not all, of the discoveries that we have, most of them fit into the Standard Model. There are, however, some important anomalies that Professor Baer especially has been emphasizing, and there, oh, I see this green, of course, this doesn't work. One is the issue of dark matter, which, as he pointed out, Fritz Zwicky realized starting in 1933, believe it or not, that there appears to be more gravitating matter in the universe than can be accounted for by the stars and the luminous matter in the universe. In addition, starting in late 1990s, there was conclusive evidence of neutrino oscillations, and even more surprising, the issue of dark energy. I think, however, we are about to enter a new age that we might, for lack of a better term, and I'm sure that name will be replaced when we actually find out what's going on, what might be called the TEV era, where we're actually starting to explore TEV physics. So I think it's reasonable to say that the Standard Model, which has reigned, the tyranny of the Standard Model, which has reigned for more than 30 years, will end at something around 2010 or maybe before. Okay? So that's sort of where we are. So I want to discuss that, elaborate on that a little bit. I'd like to use the metaphor that the Standard Model is a dinosaur in two senses of that. First, it is doomed. It will be supplanted, I believe, by something else in the next few years. On the other hand, it's important to remember that the dinosaurs were a terribly successful species that lived on the Earth for hundreds and 200 million years or something like that. Okay, and the Standard Model has been extraordinarily successful and in explaining unifying a vast variety of different phenomena in one theoretical framework. So, I don't actually think this plot has been shown here, although maybe Tanabashi-san did. This is the summer 06 summary of the status of the Standard Model. What's listed here is a bunch of precision measurements, and what's plotted is the difference between the measured value of each observable and the standard model best fit value divided by the experimental uncertainty. So this is called the pull. It is the difference in number of sigma for each measurement that the measurement deviates from the standard model. And some of the things like MZ are basically inputs and there's essentially no pull. But you'll see that some don't really, you know, don't work all that well. A forward, backward of the B has been a problem for a long time. Most of these measurements really haven't been changing in the last few years. Basically, everything above this line are LEP1 measurements, and although there are some theoretical issues about alpha electromagnetic, which, again, cleverly is in blue, so you can't see it. Most of these values really are LEP1 values that haven't been changing. However, there have been important changes, especially in the top mass, and then there's continuing improvement in the W mass from LEP2, continuing analyses of LEP2 and from the Tevatron and the W width. Nonetheless, if you close your eyes and simply add all of these in quadrature as you are sometimes told to do in elementary statistics, you get a chi-squared per degree of freedom, which isn't so bad, 18 for 13 degrees of freedom, which gives you a confidence level of 16.6, which is not so bad. On the one hand, it means the standard model is ruled out at the 84% confidence level, but it's ruled in at the 90% confidence level. There's another important aspect of the standard model that we haven't actually talked as much about in this conference, which is the flavor sector of the standard model and the CKM matrix. As you know, all of the flavor structure in the standard model arises from the Yukawa couplings, and those Yukawa couplings give rise both to the masses of all the quarks and the leptons, as well as the mixing angles. So the masses are input parameters, you have to just measure them. And the mixing angles, there are three mixing angles in one phase in the CKM matrix. And the CKM matrix is a unitary matrix, and therefore, if you take the sum, if you take U times U dagger, you always get the identity. So if you look at an off-diagonal element, I guess V is the term you can use here. If you look at an off-diagonal element of VV dagger, it must be a set of a sum of three complex parameters, which must be equal to zero if it's an off-diagonal element. So here's an important one that includes a lot of the parameters that appear in many different standard model processes. The product of VCB with VCD, VTB with VTD, and VUB with VDD, VUD, excuse me. When you add those up, you're simply getting the BBD off-diagonal matrix element of VV dagger. So that should, if I think of this as a set of vectors in the complex plane, that should add up to zero. So I can write that as some set of vectors in the complex plane, which is what's done here. It's also traditional to normalize by the length of this one, so that by definition, the base of, you get a triangle here, the base of this triangle by definition is equal to 1. Now, in terms of this plane, a vast number of different flavor measurements give constraints as to where the vertex of this triangle should be. So, for example, here's epsilon k, CP violation in the kaon system. Could either be in principle out here or out here and be consistent with the CKM model. Here are direct measurements of B to U versus B to C. Here are a bunch of things having to do with B meson mixing, B sub D and B sub S. Here's sine 2 beta, which we've done, which the experimentalists at the B factory have had heroic efforts to measure. And, of course, the point is that all of these actually are consistent with one another in this region right here. So far as we can tell, the flavor sector as well, and Professor Hagiwara told us even the slight anomalies that one was worried about in the flavor sector appear to be going away, but the vast majority of the physics in the flavor sector is also consistent with the standard model. Now, we know that the dinosaurs, or we believe the dinosaurs became extinct because of an impact from some large astronomical object, like a meteor. And just like that, this actually says the sky is beginning to fall. You can't read it back in the back, probably. In the same way, those hints that especially Professor Baer has been emphasizing do tell us there are some things beyond the standard model, or likely to be things beyond the standard model. So let me just briefly review those. The first is the issue of neutrino oscillations, also a topic that we really haven't discussed in great detail in this conference. Again, any of the subjects in this conference could be the subject of a year-long course, so it's not surprising that not everything can be covered. Neutrino oscillations really have been established in modern times by three results from three different experiments, the Super Kamiokande experiment and the Camland experiment in Japan. Those two are in Japan. And the SNOW experiment at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in Canada. And the results of those can be summarized in a plot of delta m squared for different mass eigenstates of neutrino versus the tangent squared of the relevant mixing angle. Now, we know there are three, I actually know there are three kinds of neutrinos, at least three, the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino, which means there should be at most two independent mass squares from those three different masses. Those two independent mass squares nicely coincide with experimental evidence for atmospheric neutrino oscillation, which comes both from the Super Kamiokande experiment, looking at muon neutrinos arising from cosmic rays, as well as from the K2K accelerator experiment, and now also the MINOS experiment, although I don't believe the MINOS experiment data is in the fit so far. And we know that's pretty consistently explained by saying that the muon neutrino oscillates to the tau neutrino with a nearly maximal mixing angle, tangent squared theta close to 1. Similarly, the Super Kamiokande and SNOW experiments and the Camland experiments have pretty well established that the electron neutrino also oscillates, presumably to something that's some combination of mu and tau, that with a different delta m squared and also nearly maximal mixing angle. And it's intriguing that both of those mixing angles are, so far as we can tell, pretty consistent with maximal. And this neutrino mass squared difference via the MSW mechanism accounts for the solar neutrino deficit, which for a long time, if you went to a conference about 10 years ago, there was always a talk, is there a solar neutrino problem or is there a problem in our understanding? Is there a neutrino problem or a problem in our understanding of the sun? And that's fairly definitively now, that has definitively been established as a neutrino mass squared, but there's something interesting in the physics of the neutrinos. There is, of course, one other issue, and that is there is one more experiment, the LSND experiment, that quotes a non-negative result for neutrino oscillations, and it's fit by neutrino mass squared difference, which is much larger. And so if this is confirmed, and that this is something to keep your eye on, because there is the Mini-Boon experiment, which has been alleged to be ready to announce its results now for the last couple of years, and now it really looks like they will perhaps by the end of this year. If they confirm this experiment, that will establish then that there are three different mass squared differences, and therefore must be at least four different neutrinos of some sort, otherwise you couldn't get three mass squared differences. Okay, but if you were a betting person, you'd probably say that may or may not be confirmed. There are a number of questions which neutrino oscillations give rise to. For example, we don't know what the overall mass squared of all of these are. The oscillation experiments only tell us about the differences of mass squared, so there's no sense of what this overall offset is. We also don't know the actual ordering, whether the atmospheric difference sits above the solar difference or the solar difference sits above the atmospheric difference. Those are two different possibilities. I forget which is which. I think this is called normal and this is called inverted, but we don't really know. We don't know which of those obtain. Most crucially, we don't know whether these masses, we know that they're oscillations. Oscillations imply the existence of masses, but we don't know whether those masses are Dirac masses or whether they're Majorana masses. And that has an enormous, that makes an enormous difference. In some sense, Dirac masses can be accommodated by a trivial change in the standard model. It's not even clear that it should be called necessarily physics beyond the standard model. One simply introduces rather strange objects, right-handed neutrinos, which are complete gauge singlets, and introduces Yukawa couplings, which are unbelievably small, but then we don't know anything about any of the other Yukawa couplings either, and arranges their couplings so as to get the appropriate masses and mixings. On the other hand, if they are Majorana masses, meaning that they are lepton number violating masses involving only the left-handed neutrinos themselves, then that necessarily means that there's some relation of this sector to something having to do with, well, if not electroweak symmetry breaking, perhaps an extended sector of electroweak symmetry breaking. There have to be either triplet Higgs bosons with very small BEVs or an effective triplet Higgs boson by the seesaw mechanism, which arises from two doublet Higgs exchanged through with some heavy interaction. So the issue of whether or not the neutrino masses are Majorana is crucial. And there is the possibility, there's certainly a suite of experiments planned, there's the possibility that it would be possible to get down to this range, but there are no guarantees in the next decade. Dark matter. Professor Baer gave a very nice lecture yesterday giving an overall summary. What I'd like to point out about dark matter is that actually there's an amazing coincidence, and we don't know whether this coincidence is a chance or is telling us something fundamental about physics. There's amazing coincidence between the TeV scale and the properties that are required in order to have a plausible dark matter candidate. Now, as Professor Baer described, in the hot Big Bang model, there's a well-defined procedure for calculating the relic abundance of any possible dark matter candidate. You start by saying at very high temperatures, there's lots of these dark matter candidates in thermal equilibrium, then two things happen. As the universe expands, it cools, and there's a competition between the annihilation rate for the dark matter candidates and the expansion rate. And at some point, the annihilation freezes out because the universe has expanded so much and the candidate has decayed away and diluted away enough so that no particle can find its antiparticle, or if it's a Majorana object, it can't find another one of itself to annihilate. And that trade-off between annihilation and expansion depends crucially on the annihilation cross-section. And you find that in order to get the omega in dark matter candidates to be something of order 1, which we know it has to be, it may be 0.2, not 1, you need a cross-section which is tantalizingly close to a weak cross-section, about 0.1 picobar. So that argues that actually there could be a very generic relationship between the physics of the TeV scale, which has been the subject of most of this conference, electroweak symmetry breaking, and the existence of dark matter. Of course, one would like to do better. One would like to detect dark matter directly in the laboratory, as Professor Baer has described, and correspondingly produce it in an accelerator. So here is a plot of a cross-section. There are minus signs here, believe it or not, well, they don't show up, versus mass of a potential dark matter candidate. Here are bounds from existing experiments. Here's a possible detection from the DAMA detector that is very controversial because, as you can see, most of the region is directly excluded by other experiments. Here are the next generation of dark matter searches, CDMS2 and others. And here are, I presume these are supersymmetric candidates, I'm not quite sure, but here is some plausible set of dark matter candidates. And you can start to see, as Professor Baer was saying, there begins to be some overlap and some possibility that one can see, detect dark matter both in the laboratory and then perhaps at the LHC actually directly see it. That would be tremendously exciting. I should point out there is one caveat, which is a nagging doubt. And that has to do with turning this cross-section into an actual flux of dark matter particles at the detector. What's typically assumed is that the dark matter is uniformly distributed in the halo of the galaxy. And we don't really know, theoretically, whether that is absolutely true or not, or whether dark matter is clumpy in some way. If it were clumpy in some way, and that can happen purely through gravitational interactions, it doesn't necessarily require long-range interactions, if that were true, then it could be that there could be a dark matter particle up here with a large cross-section, and we're just unlucky, we happen to be in a part of the halo which is not so abundant in dark matter. I don't know how natural or unnatural it is, but it's still a possibility that one should keep in mind. Nonetheless, I think this is a reasonable place to start. Okay, I said there could be a general connection between dark matter and TeV scale physics. This point has been made very explicitly by Mark Trodden. And the argument goes essentially like this in three steps. Almost any model of electroweak symmetry breaking or of physics beyond the standard model has TeV scale new physics. Most of those have some kind of a conserved quantum number. Usually those conserved quantum numbers are to avoid something like proton decay or precision electroweak tests or something. And those could be R parity in the case of supersymmetry. It could be T parity in the case of certain little Higgs models. KK parity in the case of universal extra dimensions. It could be Technobaryon number in the case of Technicolor. And that symmetry renders the lightest particle, typically of that ilk, to be stable. And therefore, you often have a candidate for a dark matter particle, and since its intrinsic interaction scale is of order of TeV, it's at least a plausible candidate for dark matter. And to answer a question that was asked, yes, that also means Technicolor as well. In fact, just in the last week, there was a paper about Technicolor dark matter. I'm not necessarily endorsing this or not, but just to say that it is a possibility. Finally, the last in this sort of the sky is falling summary is dark energy. I think the issue here in the next decade is really experimental. What we'd like to measure is the equation of state of whatever it is that's causing the expansion of the dark matter. Remember, expansion of the universe. Remember, the expansion is being caused by a negative pressure. In general relativity, gravity responds not just to pressure, not just to energy density, but also to pressure. In fact, that's why black holes exist in general relativity. And the acceleration of the universe can be understood as a component of the universe which has some kind of a negative pressure causing gravity, causing the universe to want to expand instead of contract. Typically, that the equation of state, our ability to describe that component, is measured in terms of a parameter W, which is the ratio of the pressure to the density. For a cosmological constant, W is minus 1. There are theoretical reasons to believe that W is not likely to be less than minus 1. But in principle, observationally, it could be anything in here below 0 that could cause the expansion of the universe. By a detailed observation of the geometry of the universe, and remember when you look back in time, when you look out at very distant galaxies, you're looking back in time as well. So you're not just measuring the geometry today, but the geometry as it's evolved over time. By combining those, you can get some set of constraints on the equation of state and the the matter and dark energy component of the universe. And SNAP is one possible experiment that is proposed to try to measure that equation of state. Now, theoretically, this is kind of a vacuum. Your idea goes here. There's no good theoretical ideas about dark energy. In fact, the situation is so dire that people have thrown up their hands, and some people think we ought to just punt and use the anthropic principle instead. And roughly speaking, the argument goes like this. In string theory, we know convincingly, we believe convincingly, whatever that means, that there are exact vacuums of string theory which have exact supersymmetry. If they have exact supersymmetry, by definition, because of the supersymmetry algebra, they have a zero cosmological constant. That's the good news. Bad news is the cosmological constant isn't zero, and supersymmetry is not broke. It is broken. It's not unbroken. Okay? So how does that work? Well, the idea is maybe there are some metastable states. That goes under the state of the landscape. That the string vacuum has a bunch of sort of metastable valleys, and that some of these may have supersymmetry spontaneously broken with a very small cosmological constant. And in fact, we could, in principle, be in any of those. And in some of those, there are 5 spatial dimensions, and some 10, and some 4. The fine structure constant could be different. The gauge theories could be different. All sorts of things could be different in these different vacua. And the only thing we really have to resort to, that last refuge of scoundrels, the anthropic principle, that says that, well, I mean, in order for us to ask the question, we have to be here to ask the question, and therefore, we have to choose some vacuum which has the plausibility of having something like us here to ask about it. As you can see, this is a somewhat nebulous concept, but you can ask, possibly, if you can categorize all of the vacua of string theory, also a difficult thing and not necessarily convincingly done, if you can do so, you can start to ask correlations of questions. You can start to ask, well, if there's a small cosmological constant, is it likely that there's TeV scale supersymmetry breaking? Or things like that. All right. So now I come to the TeV era, which, as I say, I think will be like the Cretaceous extinction, be some new era where the standard model will be superseded by something else. And just to remind you, why are we worried about the TeV scale? Well, all of the lectures in this summer school discuss that, and it has to do with loss of unitarity in WW scattering, or at least that's one direct way of saying it. And just to remind you, this is a slide that I showed before, if you simply calculate longitudinal WW scattering using the vertices that are there because of gauge invariance of the standard model, you find that those arising purely from gauge invariance do not give rise to a scattering amplitude that grows like the energy squared, and that's inconsistent. The Higgs boson is one possible way of eliminating that, that gives a contribution that exactly cancels the bad high energy behavior and gives you at least a leading term, which is a constant and not growing with energy squared. So let's look at the standard model again more closely. Is all really well with the standard model? This is the famous blue bar plot that Professor Tanabashi showed, and if you say, oh, I want delta chi-squared to be less than 3, that's some 95.6, is it, percent confidence level, then I get a bound on the Higgs mass of around 200 or so. However, there's another way of looking at the standard model, which I think is equally interesting, it's intriguing at least, and that is you can view the standard model as a prediction in the MTMW plane. So you imagine fixing alpha, G Fermi, and MC, then using all of the one-loop machinery in the standard model, you can predict, for a given value of M Higgs, you can predict where we lie in the MTMW plane. And if you use only the indirect measurements from LEP1 and SLD, so those are only measurements involving measurements at the Z pole, so at energies of 90 GeV, you find the 68% confidence region looks like this. On the other hand, if you look at direct measurements of MW that come from LEP2 and the Tevatron, and direct measurements from the Tevatron of the top quark mass, which have shifted down considerably in the last year, you find that the situation doesn't look so great. There, 114 is the experimental bound on the Higgs mass, and if you look at, if you take this blue ellipse literally, you would say the standard model is already excluded at some, I don't know, 65% confidence level. Okay, but as Mark Twain reminded us by quoting Benjamin Disraeli, there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, and this is only statistics, okay? So we have to, really what we want to do is to actually probe the interactions at a short distance scale and see what's actually there. Well, so how would we do that? For the Higgs, this is a plot from a real experimentalist, Bruce Mulato at Atlas. And there, as both as Professor Hagiwara and then Professor Baer this morning have emphasized, there are lots and lots of different channels that one can look for the Higgs boson in, and it depends on the mass. And Higgs to WW really and ZZ really starts to take off over for heavier Higgs boson masses. Since we're doing this in the context of the standard model, we've cut this plot off at 200 GeV. And the combination shows you the luminosity, at least in this simulation, required for a 5-sigma discovery of the Higgs boson. And the reason for showing you this really is here. In some ways, the situation has changed considerably. This was the plot that was given in the technical design reports for the Atlas experiment in 1999 as the projected luminosity required to discover a Higgs boson as a function of mass. And the luminosity required was ended up being around 10 inverse femtobarns for 140 GeV mass, and for a light Higgs below 120, something more like 30 inverse femtobarns. By doing work and actually paying attention to some theorists, including Peter Zeppenfeld and David Rainwater, among others, they've combined more channels and more possibilities looking for more exclusive states, and in principle, they believe that the situation is significantly better, and that's a big deal. The difference between 30 inverse femtobarns and 7 inverse femtobarns is several graduate student years. So that's a significant change. Now, again, one should not take this plot literally. You have to remember the Atlas experiment isn't commissioned. It has not taken one iota of data of any sort. The LHC has not delivered any beam. So this is the best projection one can have, and there'll be an enormous amount of work required in order to establish this. But this starts to give us a scale that perhaps we can already start to have some meaningful results in the 1 inverse femtobarn range, and perhaps we can actually know quite a bit by 10 inverse femtobarn. Now, what are the problems with the Higgs boson? This is a portion of the slide from Professor Simmons. The one that always gets the headline, the one that everyone always talks about, is the hierarchy in the naturalist problem. And that is a theoretical problem. But it's important to realize that it's only a theoretical problem. It's not a problem of principle. There are, however, other reasons that I think are equally important to keep in mind, and not least of these, that we've never observed a fundamental scalar ever in nature. Okay, so the world will be rather different if we have, and it's important to keep that in mind. this is again a theoretical issue. There's no explanation of electroweak symmetry breaking. This is actually a real issue that the theory itself is not self-consistent. It's not necessarily a practical issue if the Higgs is sufficiently light. If the Higgs weighs less than 180 GeV or so, then the theory is self-consistent up to the gut scale or beyond. On the other hand, if we find a Higgs boson that weighs 400 GeV, 500 GeV, 600 GeV, this is a serious issue. So if we want to eliminate the Higgs boson, we arrive at a fork in the road, and Yogi Berra tells us that when you arrive at a fork in the road, you should take it. There are various possibilities to try to deal with the problems of the Higgs boson in the standard model. We can make the Higgs boson natural. That's perhaps the most popular explanation, and that involves supersymmetry, as was nicely described by Professor Baird. We can make the Higgs boson a composite of some sort. And here I'm distinguishing between technicolor and composite Higgs bosons. I really mean here a theory in which there is a state that's an isospin zero scalar object, but is made out of other objects in the same way that, say, the pions are made out of quarks. Finally, you can eliminate the Higgs boson. Those, I think, are a reasonable categorization. Now, supersymmetry and technicolor and Higgsless models have been the subject of many lectures here, so I'll only touch on them. I do want to spend a little bit more time on composite Higgs, because it is a possibility that hasn't been discussed. And really, I'll only talk about little Higgs, but I should mention that there is the possibility, in the context of a model in higher dimensions, of treating the Higgs boson as an extra component of a gauge field. And the reason I'm not treating it is that in many ways, if you deconstruct such a theory, you end up with a little Higgs theory anyway. So in many ways, the little Higgs theory captures a lot of that, the same physics. There's another possibility recently, which is the twin Higgs, which will be on the slides if you look at them later, but I probably will not cover it in detail because we don't have time. Supersymmetry was very nicely summarized for us in the series of lectures by Professor Baer. Here, you make the Higgs boson natural by relating the mass of the Higgs boson to the mass of its fermionic partner, the Higgsino. And the mass of its fermionic partner can be protected by a chiral symmetry, just like we don't ask why the up quark is light. It's not a naturalness problem for the up quark to be light. We'd like to understand the Yukawa coupling, but it can naturally be light because in the limit that the up quark mass goes to zero, there's an enhanced chiral symmetry. Similarly, if the Higgs mass is related to the Higgsino mass, which is a fermion, then the Higgsino mass can be naturally light because of a chiral symmetry. Now, supersymmetry is very elegant. It is the natural generalization of space-time symmetries, in some sense the most general one, although there could be different versions of supersymmetry in four dimensions. Only n equals 1 is chiral, however, so that's the one that we spend most of our time talking about. It does come at a fairly steep price. There's more than double the number of matter states because you have to have superpartners for every gauge boson polarization state, every fermion polarization state. And as described, we need a second Higgs boson and its partners as well. So we have to more than double the number of states relative to the standard model. There are some 124 different parameters. So really the issue of supersymmetry is, can we find the superpartners? That's the issue. Why is it that supersymmetry captures the imagination of so many? This is supposed to be a perspective talk, so this is my perspective. I think the primary reason is this one, that gauge coupling unification appears to occur naturally in supersymmetry. And that is a compelling, I think, and very interesting result. Now, it is important to keep in mind that in order to do that, we have to extrapolate from 100 GeV to 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay, so we do extrapolate over 14 orders of magnitude. And it's a little better than that because it turns out that you can actually add more stuff in here as long as they all come in as SU5 multiplets, as a complete multiplets of SU5. You continue to have unification, although where the unification occurs does change. But nonetheless, you're making a strong extrapolation going from over 14 orders of magnitude in order to get to the gut scale. So, I think coupling constant unification is really the driving force behind supersymmetry in many ways. Okay, or we can try to have a composite Higgs boson. So most of these theories can be constructed or described as follows. You would like the Higgs boson to arise as a pseudo-Goldstone boson of some kind of chiral symmetry breaking interaction. So the canonical example of a pseudo-Goldstone boson are the pions in QCD. If the up and the down quark masses were zero, there would be an SU2 left plus SU2 right chiral symmetry in QCD, which is spontaneously broken, and that gives rise to three massless Goldstone bosons. Well, the pions aren't in fact massless. The reason is the up and the down quark masses are not quite zero, but they're small. And that's actually the explanation for why the pions are so much lighter than all of the other states. The next lightest states made out of up and down quarks are the rho mesons, which weigh some six times the pion mass. Okay. So Professor Simmons showed you there's a whole suite of possible kinds of chiral symmetry breaking structures that you can write down and from consistent quantum field theories. Then what you do is you imagine adding small symmetry breaking interactions. And since we're trying to explain mass, we don't want to add other small masses. Typically what we do is add gauge interactions. And so those gauge interactions, so the canonical example of that is the difference between the pi plus and pi zero mass in QCD. The pi plus and pi zero mass in QCD are different. They're not different actually because the up and down quark masses are different. The pi plus and pi minus and pi zero are still made out of up and down quark. They're actually different because of the electromagnetic interactions of the pi plus and minus. Whereas the pi zero has none, at least no coherent weak interactions. So the addition of small weak gauge interactions can give rise to small amounts of electroweak symmetry breaking, and you can easily construct situations in which you get particles which are light compared to their fundamental scale. The fundamental scale then is given by the decay constant F of the chiral symmetry breaking parameters, and so one ends up with a inverted wineglass potential or Mexican hat potential for the Higgs boson, whose generic form would look like this, that the potential for this putative would be Higgs boson. Well, first of all, it would go to zero. There would be no non-derivative interactions if there weren't any gauge interactions, so it's proportional to g squared over 16 pi squared. And then some kind of a, usually you can get rid of all of the odd terms because of some parity symmetry. So then there'll be some kind of a quadratic Higgs interaction, some kind of quartic Higgs interaction. And this one has to have a mass scale in it. The natural mass scale is the F constant of the theory, F squared. But as Professor Tanabashi pointed out, if you have new interactions that couple to the Higgs boson, that naturally gives rise to the non-decoupling precision electroweak deviations that he discussed, in particular S and possibly T. And if you just put in those constraints, you can convince yourself that F, again, there are as many different estimates as there are people who do them, but you get an F which is greater than 3, 4, 5 TeV. Okay, but you know that you want the Higgs mass squared A to be negative. That's not so hard to do, but you want the VEV that comes out to be much less than 3, 4, 5 TeV, which means that you need the ratio of A to 2 to A to 4 to be small, which means you need to... So it's not good enough, if you look at the potential, it's not good enough to just have generic size for each of the interactions. One of them has to be suppressed much more than the other. And that's the whole difficulty in creating a composite Higgs boson. And this is an idea that goes back a long way. And here, in the old versions, people simply did that by hand. That was a fine-tuning in some sense. And in little Higgs models and other models that are discussed now, it happens more naturally. And the key to understanding the physics of how it happens more naturally actually has a nice physical interpretation. It's due to collective symmetry breaking. And this is, of course, this is my favorite physical system, a coupled harmonic oscillator. And one way of understanding collective symmetry breaking is to think about how you can make a very weakly coupled oscillator out of a bunch of very stiff springs. The way you do it is you put a bunch of very stiff springs in series. When you do that, the overall spring constant for pulling the masses at the ends apart can be very weak. And the reason it can be very weak is that you have many, many stiff springs. Each one of them doesn't have to stretch very much. And that's how you can get weak coupling from this side to this side out of some relatively small, strong coupling. And collective symmetry breaking, and this is about as far as I'm going to go in the description, collective symmetry breaking has to do with adding, the analogy would be that in each of these springs would be a small symmetry breaking interaction, and the piece of the interaction that gives rise to A to 2 involves more of these links, and is therefore suppressed relative to A to 4. And the typical, in fact, the best you can do, turns out to be a ratio of 8 to 2 to 8 to 4, which is suppressed by one factor of some small weak gauge interaction. And therefore, you typically get a prediction that the mass square root of the Higgs is F, but suppressed by G over 4 pi. So that's, again, consistent, perhaps, with getting a ratio of 100 GeV to 3 TeV or something. And here's just a list of all the different, list from Patrick Mead, of a bunch of different little Higgs models. And some of the properties, the global symmetry properties, the chiral symmetry breaking and global properties, the gauge symmetries that are introduced, whether they have triplet Higgses or not, how many Higgses they have, they come in all sorts of varieties. In these models, special attention and care has to be paid to the third generation, because the third generation has the highest mass. And so the large top quark Yukawa coupling breaks the chiral symmetries, and you have to be sure that you introduce it in such a way so as not to destroy the collective symmetry breaking mechanism that you went to so much trouble to introduce. That typically requires adding more singlet quarks. It typically requires, you get typically a C-top mass, which comes from a seesaw-like mechanism. And interestingly enough, many of these models have radiative electroweak symmetry breaking in them as well. So that's kind of nice. In some ways, I think the radiatively induced symmetry breaking here is more natural even than in supersymmetry. In supersymmetry, radiatively induced symmetry breaking has to do with a competition between the mu parameter, which is a supersymmetry conserving mass squared for the Higgs boson, and the running of the negative running of the mass squared arising from the top quark loop, typically. And you have to have some mechanism in mind that allows the supersymmetry preserving mu parameter only to be of order of TeV to start with. If it's 10 to the 16 GeV, all hope is lost. Here, the positive mass squared that results automatically starts at order of TeV squared. And so the radiatively induced symmetry breaking is in some ways even more natural. You can ask the question, in the context of little Higgs models, how is it that you solve the hierarchy problem? In supersymmetry, as Professor Baer showed, there's a cancellation diagram by diagram of the quadratic divergences from exchange of ordinary particles and superpartners. Well, in the little Higgs model, something rather similar happens, but because of the collective symmetry breaking structure, it's rather, it looks different. So suppose you consider the top quark loop contribution to the Higgs mass. That turns out to be canceled by this rather peculiar looking, non-renormalizable interaction involving the exchange of the partners of the top quark. And it has the opposite sign. Again, these are both fermion loops. There's two fermion loops that are canceling. It has the opposite sign because this interaction has the opposite sign. And the similar thing can be done with the gauge boson loops. There are cancellations between the SU2 gauge bosons, and all of these models typically have a second SU2, and there's a cancellation between these two. So here you get a cancellation of divergences between particles of the same spin. So here's kind of an energy diagram look at what you might see in such a model. You see some Higgs doublets at low energies. At around a TeV, you have to see these extra states, these extra top quarks or extra W bosons. And then up at some higher scale, there has to be some UV completion. And because you've changed, basically, if you turn this around, if instead of having one Higgs boson and you put two gluons here, that's the gluon fusion mechanism for creating the Higgs boson. Similarly here, you can have a single Higgs boson and some gluons. And so what you find is one possible signature of this scenario is that the Higgs boson cross-section can actually, production cross-section can be suppressed in these models. That's unfortunate. It's different, so that's experimentally nice. It goes in the wrong direction. It suppresses it as opposed to enhancing it, which makes things more difficult. All right, I'm not going to cover the twin Higgs, but it's another model on the market for producing. That was the end. That was not what I wanted. Okay. Sorry about that. That was twin Higgs. I'm not going to talk about it, but you can look at the slides and the references that are given. The last possibility, which was discussed in this workshop, is to eliminate the Higgs altogether. Technicolor has been Higgsless since 1976. It eliminates the scalars. The electroweak gauge symmetry is broken by a condensate of fermions instead of the expectation value of a scalar. As Professor Simmons has emphasized, our understanding of how to construct these theories is limited because of our understanding of how to know how to do calculations in strongly interacting theories. Nonetheless, there are limits that you can look up on different kinds of technicolor theories in the literature. They're rather model dependent. They're just starting to reach the interesting range. Run 2 and the LHC will really significantly extend those limits. So those are things to look for direct searches. What about the S parameter? This has been the result of something that we've talked about quite a bit. As Professor Simmons has pointed out, there are no computations of S in a non-QCD-like technicolor theory. So we don't actually have a computation. That's not necessarily so good, but it's a fact of life. I think the most interesting reason to continue to talk about technicolor is that it has interesting experimental signatures which are complementary to those that you might see in other kinds of theories. And that's, I think, really the issue. The issue is we should be looking for a wide enough variety of things that we cover all the possibilities. Finally, I gave you some theoretical rigmarole down here, the ADS-CFT correspondence, which tells us that maybe there are different kinds of strongly interacting theories whose dual are these five-dimensional Higgsless models that I talked about, and they give us new ideas of addressing the model-building problems, in particular the S parameter. So here's just one slide of LHC phenomenology from a Higgsless model. This is from Bergdahl et al., which shows how you might see a resonance in WZ scattering. This is for, I guess, a 600 GeV or so W prime. But notice this is number of events for 100 GeV for a luminosity of 300 inverse femtobarns. 300 inverse femtobarns is probably 2012, 13, 14, maybe 15. It's a long haul, the 300 inverse femtobarns of integrated luminosity. But it's probably true that in this model you first don't find a Higgs boson, you don't find a Higgs boson, you see WW scattering, then you start to see some kind of a peak emerge. 700. Well, okay. So the situation could be better. As we argued, they could be as light as 500 GeV, and the situation would be much better for 500 GeV. Okay, so here, this is a provocative slide. This is one way of trying to put all models beyond the standard model in some context. You can talk about the amount of fine-tuning required to make the model phenomenologically consistent versus how exotic the signatures are. A lot of these dynamical symmetry-breaking models, and I put all of these in that category, fall on some kind of a trade-off line. The more fine-tuning you get, the more you get like the minimal standard model. And in some sense, if you take a composite Higgs model and you take the scale of the compositeness up to infinity, you just recover the standard model. That requires an enormous amount of fine-tuning. So the minimal standard model is very highly finely tuned, but it's rather low in exotic signatures. Almost by definition. By exotic, we mean those things that aren't in the standard model. And as you get down to theories that are less fine-tuned, they're rather more exotic signatures. That's both good and bad. That's good because there's a lot of interesting phenomenology, but it means there's a lot of potential for dangerous things in terms of constraints. Now, where does supersymmetry lie on here? That's, I think, everyone you ask will have a different question, a different answer to that question. It clearly has lots of exotic signatures, so I would put it up here somewhere. How much fine-tuning and whether or not that's a relevant criterion, I'm not entirely sure. Some people would say that the bounds that we already, remember that the tree level prediction for the Higgs mass in supersymmetry is that its mass squared mass is less than the Z boson mass. It's only because of radiative corrections that the mass gets pushed up at all. In the minimal model, it seems difficult to make it much higher than, say, 120 or so, although there are other extensions beyond the minimal model. So there are some who would say that the minimal supersymmetric standard model, well, so that's one problem. Supersymmetry is not just one theory. It's many different kinds. Some would say that the minimal supersymmetric standard model is already starting to get in the relatively finely tuned range. Whether it should be here, right down by the standard model, or somewhere here is, of course, a matter of debate. So here's some observations about physics models beyond the standard model. The first is, I think it's important to remember that our standards have changed over the last decade. We no longer worry so much about trying to write down a theory of everything or nearly everything or a theory that's good up to 10 to the 15 GeV as much. As Professor Baer has emphasized, even in supersymmetry, it's really only a low energy effective theory. You have to input soft supersymmetry breaking masses. You have to have the parameters of those correct to be phenomenologically consistent. So we're really content with a low energy effective theory, which is valid to a few TeV, perhaps higher than that in the case of supersymmetry, but really a low energy effective theory. I think this is a good thing. It's a good thing because in preparation for the LHC, I think the issue again, as I said, is being sure to cover all of the possible experimental signatures that are out there. and not necessarily being tied to one specific theoretical paradigm or another. The other thing is that fine-tuning is, I think, very much in the eye of the beholder. You will often see statements in the literature that, oh, such and such a parameter, which is naturally of order 1, has to be 0.1. So that's 10% fine-tuning. I think that is kind of a vacuous statement. If you believe that, then you would say Technicolor is just 10% fine-tuned, because Technicolor has an S which is of order 1, and it needs to be 0.1, so that's only 10% fine-tuning. I don't actually believe that, but it is a logical extension of what is often said. The point is that dynamics matter. Okay, the biggest fine-tuning problem we have any sense of a solution of is the flatness problem in cosmology. It's the problem that if you go backward in the evolution of the universe down to the conditions of the Big Bang, you would find that the density at the moments right after the Big Bang differ from the critical density for a flat universe by a very, very, very small amount. Because when you go backwards, that difference gets magnified. And we know that today, omega is very close to 1. In fact, if you take the WMAP results, say between 1.1 and 0.9. And if you go backward in the universe, that means that difference was very, very, very small. That was a terrible problem, but we actually don't even talk about it anymore. The reason we don't talk about it is we all believe in inflation. And with that dynamical paradigm, inflation naturally gives us a flat universe. So really, in order to understand fine-tuning, whether something is finely tuned or not, one has to have some sense of the dynamics that's involved. So in supersymmetry, one has to have some sense of the supersymmetry breaking dynamics. In Technicolor, one has to have some sense of the strong dynamics. So here are some interim conclusions. There are three. I didn't mean to slight supersymmetry by putting it in green. It's because I just can't remember that green doesn't show up. But here are three mechanisms to address the hierarchy problem: supersymmetry, composite Higgs, Technicolor. And they all give a wealth of predictions of things in the TEV scales, either superpartners or extended electroweak gauge symmetries or an extended fermion sector or sometimes more of them. Now, so here's an answer, I think, to one of the questions I started out with. If you're a theorist, what is it you should be doing? I think there's a lot of interesting phenomenology left to be done. As Professor Baer has shown, in many ways, supersymmetry is ahead of the game. There's much more well-developed phenomenology. But the phenomenology is vast. I think there are plenty of things still to think about. One interesting thing that occurred to me in thinking and preparing this talk is that the three of the lecturers who come from the United States, Professor Baer, Professor Simmons, and myself, were all SSC fellows, which means that early in our careers, is that right, Howie? I think so. So early in our careers, when we were thinking about, you know, either young faculty or postdocs, one of the things that we did was think carefully, or try to think carefully, about the phenomenology of what was going to then happen at the superconducting supercollider. That was canceled, and we all went through some relatively lean years in the United States. But I think as a world, we're now at the situation with the LHC turning on, that there is a great opportunity to think from that point of view, to think from the phenomenology back to the theory. And I think that's a very important point of view to have, and gives a certain reality to it that it wouldn't have otherwise. Okay, I'll finish up here in a minute. Our future is the LHC, as Professor Hagiwara has explained to us. I think this is consistent with what he said. The LHC schedule is to start with low luminosity running at 900 GeV at the end of 2007, then in 2008 to start coming to a 14 TeV physics run, ultimately, hopefully by the end. Low luminosity should be achieved sometime, maybe around 2008, in the beginning of 2009. That's defined as, according to Ian Hinchliffe, as 2 times 10 to the 33. If you remember Hagiwara's rule of thumb that there's 10 to the 7 seconds in a year, this is one of the things I learned as an SSC fellow. That means 20 inverse femtobarns per year, right, Howie? So I don't know if that 10 to the 7 duty cycle really will occur, but nonetheless, that means that you can start to get tens of femtobarns certainly by 2010, and then possibly ramp up to 10 to the 34, which would be 100 inverse femtobarns. This is probably optimistic, but this is the kind of scale that we're talking about. So if you remember back to that Higgs plot, then sometime, that's where I put the 2010 on my tombstone at the beginning, sometime before around 2010, we should have some sense of a lot about the standard model Higgs, at least. This is assuming all goes well, but there's no point in assuming it goes badly. So. Okay, what about the physics program? It's important to remember that what we're going to do with the LHC in the beginning is rediscover the standard model, especially when we're starting at 900 GeV. So we're going to talk about jets, we're going to talk about maybe perhaps some W's and Z's, depends on the luminosity. And I think, and so there's really, I think, another opportunity, and that is understanding the physics of the standard model at the LHC is important, not just for understanding the detectors, but understanding the backgrounds to any of the new physics processes. And as Professor Baer emphasized, many of the tools that people use, Monte Carlo's detector simulations, many of them are freely available on the web. And if you start to become familiar with that, you will have vital skills, I think, that will be important in the LHC era. It is also, I think, important to remember Hagiwara's dictum that it's important to be able to do some calculations on the back of an envelope. You have to be able to do both, and that's an important skill to have. Okay. Ian Hinchliffe, who made this transparency, makes the point that it's important to pay attention to this phase. It might seem like this is the boring part, right? Remembering how to, rediscovering the standard model might be the boring part, because what we really want to understand is physics beyond the standard model. But the point is, if you shouldn't believe any new discovery until you're sure you understand the old stuff, right? It's very easy, for example, to find supersymmetry at the LHC if half of your detector isn't working, the right half, for example. What will we see? No one knows. This is Toshi Murayama's dream of the possible landscape of physics beyond the standard model. I've added a few things because the slide's a bit out of date. What is the most wild thing we could possibly see? Well, maybe black holes. Large extra dimensions, as I pointed out in my lecture, large extra dimensions give rise to the possibility that the fundamental Planck scale could be of order a TeV. And if you think about how the Schwarzschild radius scales in general relativity, it goes like the Newton's constant times the energy that's enclosed, which is to say the energy enclosed divided by, in four dimensions, the Planck mass squared. Well, that means that gives you a radius which is proportional to 1 over the Planck mass squared. It's a very small amount. But if the Planck scale is instead a TeV, then the geometrical cross-section associated with the Schwarzschild radius of a TeV scale energy collision may be of order a TeV, in which case, if we are so lucky, it may be possible to actually create black holes from large extra dimensions at the Large Hadron Collider. What does that actually look like? Well, Demopoulos and Landsberg, among others, have tried to actually compute, just basically using that geometrical cross-section, the cross-section as a function of black hole mass, because this isn't a single particle, right? Black holes can be created at any energy, at any mass. And you see that you can get rather large cross-sections if the Planck mass is only a 2 TeV, which would happen if the number of extra dimensions is 7, unlikely perhaps. But if that were so, you'd have a half a nanobarn cross-section, which is enormous. Okay. And here's another perhaps somewhat more realistic possibility with only 3 extra dimensions and a 6 TeV Planck mass of 120 femtobars. What would you actually see? Well, if you create a black hole, then black holes do decay by Hawking radiation. And one of the interesting things about Hawking radiation is, well, first of all, they're spherical. They go off in all different directions. They're isotropic. They're also universal. They basically create things according to the number of states that are present. So there's no innate suppression for electroweak gauge bosons, say, relative to gluons. So you could imagine W plus W minus events or things with multiple Ws and multiple Zs, which would give rise to potentially striking signatures. So high multiplicity, high total transverse energy, high sphericity. Most of what we talk about at high transverse energy comes from parton-parton interactions are very jet-like. It's not spherical typically. High missing PT potentially from Zs. This democratic decay into everything that you can possibly reach. So to find out what we actually will see, we'll have to return in 2010. And I'd like to take the opportunity as the last speaker to thank all the students and lecturers for a wonderful workshop, and the organizers, the staff, and the sponsors, and especially our hosts, Dr. Kwong and Dr. He. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jack. Professor Chibukura has given a very nice summary or review of the perspective of high energy physics. So we can still ask a couple of questions.
I have a question on the previous model based on the current theory. About
Okay, so.
So I mean, there were the siblings.
Okay, so there are, I think, two questions. One had to do with the symmetry structure of technicolor theories. Why is it not, say, U2 cross U2 or U3 cross U3? The reason is the same reason as in QCD, at least in if you have an SUN-like group, or in fact, almost any group, the U1 axial symmetry is anomalous, and therefore it doesn't give rise to a light Goldstone boson. So that means that the actual symmetry structure is typically SUN left cross SUN right cross U1 vector. And the U1 vector is unbroken, so we don't typically talk about it. The only things that participate in the symmetry breaking are SUN left cross SUN right, giving rise to the usual symmetry breaking pattern. The second question had to do with, isn't chiral symmetry restored as we increase energy? And this is a common misconception, because people often talk somewhat loosely about the restoration of symmetry arising as you increase energy. That's not really true. The vacuum is the vacuum. The vacuum breaks the chiral symmetry, and so when we do an experiment, chiral symmetry is broken, and that's just a fact of life. The difference is, if you're doing finite temperature field theory and you're calculating the partition function, which is relevant to a temperature above a TeV, and you calculate the expectation value of a chiral symmetry breaking observable, you will get something that's zero in the thermal bath. But when we do an experiment, we're not doing an experiment in a thermal bath. We're doing an experiment at zero temperature, probing the vacuum we're in at shorter distance scales. And although there is a correspondence between energy and temperature, temperature is only a relevant quantity when we're in a thermal bath, and we're not in a thermal bath at the LHC.
Other questions?
You have said that the omega of the equation, state equation, is not less than -1. Why?
Okay, so the question is, why is the equation of state parameter W bounded by -1? It has to do with the stability of the solutions of Einstein's equations when W equals -1. I don't actually remember off the top of my head what the problem is. I don't know. Howie, do you remember? Sorry? Yeah, I don't. Well, I don't remember. Right. So you're saying there are models where W can be less than -1, and again, I think the issue is whether such a model is phenomenologically viable, but phenomenology here is viable in terms of the stability of the universe, and we don't really know.
There is one more thing about concern with the
fine tuning. For the supersymmetry, the original motivation is to solve the fine tuning problem, the hierarchy problem. But now less than a year ago, the so-called splitting supersymmetry. Would you have some comments on that?
Well, so the question is, do I have any comments about supersplit supersymmetry? I think if I were being safe, I would say no. But I would put that in the category of the anthropic principle, that basically one simply says, we live with the fact that there is one fine-tuning problem having to do with the cosmological constant. If there's one, why not have two? And maybe the superpartners are much, much heavier. And maybe all we have to deal with, maybe, I forget which way it works. I guess it's the superpartners of the matter are heavy and the J-genos are still light. Is that, that's the way, what's that? The scalars are all very heavy. But again, I as far as I can tell, there isn't really a theory behind it. It's just a speculation on a scenario.
I want to ask a question about Dirac neutrino. At Dirac neutrino, it should be light at deep diameter condensation. Then very light Dirac neutrino make contradiction with the beam direction, beam prediction. Beam predicts that there should be no more no more, no much internal bleeding. Like, how can we control?
That's a very good question. The question, as I understood it, was if LSND is correct and there is a fourth neutrino, how can that be consistent with Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which bounds the number of active neutrinos at three? Well, it could be a sterile neutrino, and then it's a question of detail as to whether it's still consistent or not. I believe there are consistent regions with a fourth sterile neutrino, but I'm not an expert on that.
Okay, I think the time is late, so we stop asking questions. So, we developed some questionnaires for the student, and we received some answers. So let me give a brief review that most of the most answers state that all the lectures are excellent. They enjoy all the lectures very much. And the problem is some of the students doesn't have enough basic knowledge about the physics beyond the standard model. So, and they make some useful suggestions for the organization of future summer schools. Since this summer school is one of the serious summer schools organized by Institute of High Energy Physics, and the future summer school will still be organized by Institute of High Energy Physics. So we will convey all your suggestions to Institute of High Energy Physics and let them to consider how to improve the organization in future summer schools. So all the lectures in this summer school are very nice, very inspiring. So, on behalf of the organizing committee, let us thank all the speakers again for their excellent preparation, excellent lectures. And also, there are several people serving this school, making service for this school, guaranteeing the smoothness of running of the school. We would like to thank all of them. First of all, there are several secretaries who work very hard for arranging the accommodation, the food, the transportation, everything. So without their effort, we will not have the summer school running smoothly. So let us thank several of them. The first and most important person is Ms. Jia Yinghua. He is from IHEP. And also Ms. Zhang Jie from Tsinghua University. And also Ms. Wang Yongtao from Institute of High Energy. And also there are two others, Ms. Tan Yan and Mr. Niu Dezhan. They have been back to IHEP, but we will still thank them. And there are some graduate student volunteers serving to this summer school. Mr. Zhu Xingwang. Mr. Yang Ming. Mr. Liu Qiu Xian. Mr. Liu So. You saw them. They serve as meeting the lecturers from the airport, taking them to the hotel. And also, there are three graduate students from Tsinghua University, Mr. Lu Ran, Mr. Zhang Ying, and Mr. He Jibo. They are in charge of making the video recording, collecting all the transparencies, and put all of these things on the website. So they will continue to work after the school. Probably sometime in next week, we'll be able to put all the things on the web page. And please note it. You can go to this web page, and you can download all these things. Okay, we have already had a very successful summer school. This is the end of the summer school, but I hope that this is not the end of your research. This should be a starting point of your new improvement of your research. So make more and more effort. Okay, thank all of you for coming. The lecturers hope that if you have any further questions, just send email to them. Don't be embarrassed, just send email to them. They're happy to answer the questions.
代表今天晚上需要住在906楼的可以继续去住，然后如果有困难明天走离开也可以住在那一天啊。然后一会儿是大家去吃午餐，吃完午餐之后1点钟可以陆续的，不一定就是大家都可以慢慢吃，陆续的咱们是1点半发车，然后咱们先把行李先放在这儿吧，然后1点钟陆续回来，然后大家拿着行李上车，然后咱们是清华北大的一辆，906楼和理论所的可以一辆，然后高能所的一辆，然后咱们就可以回去了。然后就是住在906楼的和我想咱们北大的学生或者说是清华的学生，万一有住不下的可以坐的那个906楼的那辆车都可以坐，然后都往中关村走好吗？好，谢谢大家。
你又不在，在，你又不在，忘了。